Welcome to the debate. So think about building a skyscraper. You know the exact load-bearing capacity of the steel. You know the specific wind shear constraints of the environment.
Right, it's a closed system. You have known limits.
Exactly. You calculate the math, you pour the concrete, and the structure stands. It's a solved problem, basically.
Well, the mathematics are deterministic, right? If you exceed the tensile strength of that steel beam, the beam snaps. It is highly visible and, you know, entirely predictable.
But then you look at an ecosystem, or a global financial market, or even a human immune system. They face massive, completely unpredictable shocks.
Shocks that would absolutely shatter your static skyscraper, by the way.
Oh, entirely. Yet, somehow, these systems don't just survive. They adapt. They reorganize. They persist.
Right. Until they don't. I mean, until the coral reef bleaches, or the market crashes, or the body succumbs to disease. Finding that invisible line between persistence and collapse, like understanding the exact architecture of that threshold, is honestly the ultimate puzzle across the sciences right now.
It really is. And today, we are examining exactly that. The fundamental problem of why complex adaptive systems persist under disturbance, while others inevitably collapse. We are exploring this through the lens of Dr. Bachara Sahali's freshly published framework, The Viability Grammar, toward a general theory of persistence and complex adaptive systems.
It's a big paper. A lot to unpack.
A huge paper. And the central question we really must resolve today is this. Does the viability grammar represent a universal, mathematically generative theory that reveals the true underlying architecture of all complex systems? Or is it primarily just a descriptive heuristic, a framework that elegantly repackages existing disciplines without providing the empirical operationalization required for a predictive science?
That is the question, yeah.
So, to state my position clearly, I argue that this framework provides a groundbreaking, universal ontology driven by a triadic generative hypothesis that finally gives us a unified language for resilience.
And I will argue that while this synthesis is, you know, undeniably elegant, it suffers from conceptual overreach, relying heavily on analogies rather than the measurable operational mechanisms needed to truly predict system behavior.
All right, so to understand the magnitude of what this paper attempts, we kind of have to look at how fragmented our sciences have become. I mean, for decades, cybernetics studied feedback loops.
Ecology studied resilience and adaptive cycles.
Right. Cognitive science looked at predictive processing, and political science looked at institutional governance. We have basically been describing the exact same elephant in totally different languages. The viability grammar argues that we can unify these siloed traditions by identifying seven core operational elements.
And these seven elements are the absolute foundation of the entire theory.
Exactly. They are constraints, margins, optionality, disturbances, perception, regulation, and system state.
It's quite the list.
It is. But before we debate them, let's look at how they actually interact mechanically. Because this isn't just a list. Think of your own body temperature. Your body has strict constraints. If your internal temperature drops too low, you experience hypothermia and you die.
A very strict constraint, yes.
Very. Now, the cold wind outside is the disturbance. Your skin sensors provide the perception of that cold, which then triggers your nervous system's regulation to start shivering.
Right. The automatic response.
Yeah. And that shivering burns calories, eating into your physiological margins. Now, if shivering isn't enough, your optionality represents the other available states, like your ability to walk inside or put on a heavy coat. And your system state is just the real-time sum of all these factors at any given second.
Look, it is a neat conceptual mapping. I'll give it that. The synthesis of cybernetics, viability theory, and ecological resilience is indeed masterful.
It really brings it all together.
It does. Bringing W. Ross Ashby's law of requisite variety into the same conversation as C.S. Hawling's adaptive cycles is intellectually satisfying. But my perspective is that identifying seven common variables across different domains is not the same as discovering a universal generative mechanism.
You think it's just descriptive?
I think it functions largely as a philosophical repackaging. When you map the same seven variables onto a biological cell and then onto a human civilization, you are relying on conceptual analogy. You are not demonstrating a scientific proof of a shared mechanism.
But look at the specific test cases the paper already provides to back up that claim. I mean, the text asserts that this grammar applies identically across fundamentally different scales of reality. And it maps out this cross-scale recurrence beautifully.
Beautifully is a strong word.
Well, take a biological cell. A cell has constraints, like strict pH limits. It has margins, which manifest as metabolic buffering capacity against acidity. It has perception through receptor proteins and regulation through gene expression. Now scale that all the way up to an institutional system.
Like a federal government or a central bank?
Precisely. An institution has constraints in the form of legal mandates and finite budgets. Its margins are its fiscal reserves or its political capital.
Sure.
Its perception is its data monitoring and statistical agencies. And its regulation is its collective policy decision making. The variables change, sure, but the functional architecture, how they relate to maintain viability, is mathematically identical. It isn't just an analogy, it's the exact same structural blueprint.
I understand the appeal of that symmetry, I really do. I'm sorry, but I just don't buy that. Let me tell you why.
Go ahead.
The definition of these terms has to stretch so incredibly far to accommodate both a single biological cell and a sprawling human institution that they begin to lose their analytical precision.
Do they, though?
Yes. A central bank's perception involves debates, cognitive biases, intense political pressures, and, you know, delayed data reporting. A cell's perception is a direct, localized chemical reaction. But the paper goes even further down the scale. It attempts to map these elements onto physical systems, atoms, and molecules.
Which is the most fascinating part.
It's the most absurd part. Claiming that an atom operates under the same grammar as a governance structure stretches the definitions of perception and regulation to the point of absolute meaninglessness.
Okay, I see why you might think that, but let me give you a different perspective. If you're listening to this and wondering how on earth an atom can perceive something, you aren't alone. It sounds totally absurd until you look at the mechanics.
Oh, I've looked at the mechanics.
Think about the mathematics of wave dynamics.
Okay, wave dynamics. Let's hear it.
The exact same mathematical equations describe the propagation of ocean waves crashing on a beach, acoustic sound waves traveling through the air, and quantum probability waves vibrating in subatomic fields.
Right, the wave equation.
Exactly. Water, air, and quantum fields are completely distinct physical substrates. Yet, the underlying structural architecture, the wave dynamic, is genuinely substate independent.
What the viability grammar proposes is that the relational geometry of viability is similarly substrate independent.
So an atom doesn't need a central nervous system? Right. An atom doesn't need biological sensory perception. At the atomic scale, local field interactions serve the exact same functional role in the relational geometry as a receptor protein does in a cell, or, you know, a data agency does in a government. They all provide the state estimation required for the system to react to a disturbance. It is a mathematical symmetry. It's not just a semantic game.
But here's the critical difference. Wave dynamics can be proven because we have precise mathematical formulas to measure amplitude, frequency, and wavelength regardless of the substrate. I can measure a water wave and a sound wave with exact precision.
And the viability grammar has a formal geometry.
Yes, but if substrate independence requires robust mathematical architecture, we have to look at the generative engine the text proposes and really ask if it holds up to that same standard of measurement.
I'm really glad you brought that up because this is where the framework moves from a descriptive list to a true generative theory. The text proposes the triadic generative hypothesis. It suggests that the entire seven-element grammar actually emerges from just three primitive dimensions.
Just three?
Just three. Constraints, which represent structural reality and limits. Perception, which represents knowledge and state estimation. And regulation, which represents adaptive action.
Reality, knowledge, and action.
Exactly. everything else is derived from how these three interact under the forcing field of a disturbance. The paper organizes these elements into an irreducible Fano plane geometry of triadic relations.
The Fano plane.
Yeah, and for those trying to picture a Fano plane, imagine a perfectly symmetrical triangle where every corner, every midpoint, and the center are all connected by precise lines. Every single point acts as a necessary bridge for the others. It argues that viability isn't just a list of variables, it is a fundamental relational syntax.
Geometrically, it's like a landscape.
Right. Imagine the system as a landscape of hills and valleys, a multidimensional state manifold. The system is a ball rolling across this landscape. Regulation acts like an internal motor, trying to steer the ball away from the cliffs, while disturbances are the winds pushing the ball toward the edge.
That is a beautiful topological description. It gives us a really great mental image. But let's look at the actual mathematical formalization provided in the text.
The viability functional.
Yes. The paper proposes a viability functional, basically a mathematical equation for survival denoted as V star. Let me translate that equation for the audience. It calculates survival by multiplying your normalized margins, your optionality, your regulatory capacity, and your perception fidelity.
Right. They are multiplicative.
Exactly. The math implies that if just one of these elements drops to zero, say your perception goes entirely blind, your entire viability drops to zero and the system collapses.
Which perfectly tracks with reality. I mean, if a system cannot perceive a fatal disturbance, it cannot regulate against it and it dies.
Conceptually, yes, it makes total sense. But how does one precisely quantify perception fidelity or optionality in a high-dimensional institutional ecosystem?
It's harder, sure.
It's nearly impossible right now. In a biological cell, I can measure pH margins in quantifiable units. I can literally see the chemistry. How do I measure the exact margin of a legal constraint or the quantitative volume of policy optionality in a sprawling government?
You're asking for the tape measure before the blueprint is finished.
I'm asking for empirical rigor. Until we resolve this measurement challenge, the geometry remains an abstract metaphor rather than rigorous control theory. We can't plug real numbers into V-star to predict exactly when an institution will collapse.
Okay, I am just not convinced by that line of reasoning because it basically demands that a structural framework instantly provide empirical measurement tools for every possible domain before it can be considered valid. Does the requirement for immediate empirical measurement dismiss the immense value of topological thinking?
No, it doesn't dismiss it, but it limits its utility as a hard science.
But think about Jean-Pierre Aubin's viability theory, which this paper draws heavily upon. Aubin's viability kernels the mathematical sets of safe starting points from which a system can survive were initially purely theoretical mathematics.
That's true.
They were topological concepts long before they found concrete applications in robotics, autonomous driving, and economics. Even if we cannot perfectly quantify the perception fidelity of a federal agency today, doesn't identifying the geometric boundaries of margin collapse provide immense diagnostic value?
Diagnostic value is a separate claim.
But an important one. Knowing that a system's resilience is a function of its distance to a constraint boundary fundamentally changes how we govern it, even before we perfect the sensors to measure that exact distance.
It provides a way to think about it, yes, a framework for understanding. But if we are shifting from theoretical geometry to practical diagnostic application, we really have to ask whether this framework actually gives us new tools to diagnose system failure, or if it simply gives us a new vocabulary for things we already knew perfectly well.
No, it absolutely gives us novel tools specifically because of how it formally structures failure modes. The framework doesn't just wave its hands and say systems fail. It highlights three highly specific mechanistic failure modes: margin collapse, perception failure, and regulatory deficits.
Okay.
And it maps these out using those Fano plane triads I mentioned earlier.
All right, give me a concrete example of how mapping that triad provides a genuinely new insight.
Sure. Think of the 2008 global financial crisis. The text identifies the early warning dynamics triad, which intimately links margins, disturbances, and perception. In 2008, major financial institutions operated incredibly close to their constraint boundaries, meaning they had virtually zero financial margins.
Right, highly leveraged.
Highly leveraged. When the disturbance hit, the subprime mortgage default, their margins evaporated overnight.
But why did it happen? Because of a profound perception failure. Their risk models were entirely blind to the systemic entanglement.
They couldn't see the cliff.
They couldn't perceive the constraint boundary approaching. By giving us these exact triads, the viability grammar provides a constraint-aware template. It tells a governing body exactly where to look for structural vulnerabilities before the collapse actually happens.
I come at it from a different way. When we strip away the new terminology, this diagnostic utility is essentially a restatement of cybernetics mixed with ecological resilience.
A restatement?
Yes. Cybernetics, going back to the mid-20th century, already taught us about the sensor-controller feedback loop that entirely covers the concepts of perception and regulation. Resilience theory already taught us about basin stability and ecological buffers, which covers margins and disturbances.
But they existed in total isolation from each other.
Let me finish this thought, because when it comes to governance, we really have to ask whether these seven triads offer mechanisms that the great Eleanor Ostrom hadn't already identified in her Nobel-winning work on collective regulation.
Ostrom's work is brilliant, but
she mapped out exactly how communities create rules to monitor shared resources and sanction violations. She explicitly mapped out the constraints, the monitoring, which is basically perception, and the enforcement, which is regulation. So while the Fano plane geometry is a novel and frankly gorgeous visualization, the diagnostic insights derived from it, the idea that you need good data and buffers to survive a shock, are already deeply embedded in the existing literature of these siloed sciences.
That's an interesting point, though. I would frame it differently. To say this is just a restatement of cybernetics, resilience, and Ostrom's governance is like looking at a group of blindfolded people touching different parts of an elephant.
The old elephant metaphor.
It works. The cyberneticist is holding the trunk, describing a hose. The ecologist is holding the leg, describing a tree trunk. Ostrom is holding the ear, describing a fan. They are all correct in their isolated domains. What the viability grammar does is turn on the lights so we can finally see the entire animal. It provides the unifying molecular bond.
But how does it actually act as that bond?
Through the specific relational syntax it introduces. It is true that Ostrom understood institutions deeply and Holling understood ecosystems profoundly, but neither of them provided a unified syntax that could translate the dynamics of an ecosystem directly into the dynamics of a society.
Translate directly?
Yes. Look at the specific triad linking constraints, disturbances, and optionality, what the paper calls the CDO triad. It formally explains how a disturbance pressure forces a system toward a constraint boundary and how the system's survival depends entirely on the volume of its viable state space, its optionality.
Right, the room it has to maneuver.
Exactly. That specific syntax is what allows us to link an ecosystem's ecological buffer, say the genetic diversity of a forest, directly to a society's policy optionality, like a government's ability to pivot its supply chains. It shows that ecological diversity and political maneuverability are mathematically analogous functions in the geometry of survival. That isn't just repackaging Ostrom and Holling. That is a fundamental integration of how complex reality operates across all scales.
It is a powerful integration. I won't deny that seeing the mathematical symmetry between a forest's genetic diversity and a government's policy options is an intellectual breakthrough.
Thank you.
But we must maintain intellectual humility about what it achieves today. The text itself is remarkably honest about its limitations. It clearly states that margins depend on the accurate identification of constraint boundaries, and in social and planetary systems, those boundaries are often entirely invisible until you literally cross them.
Which is why perception is prioritized as a primitive dimension in the theory.
True. But it acknowledges the extreme difficulty of estimating reachable state volumes, that optionality, in high-dimensional, completely unpredictable systems. If we cannot measure the constraint boundary of a societal norm or quantify the optionality of a global economy, we cannot actively manage that viability functional, V-star.
We just need better models. We can't plug in the numbers right now. The framework brilliantly tells us what we need to measure to understand persistence. It tells us we need to measure the margins. It tells us we need to measure the perception fidelity. But it does not yet tell us how to measure them in the messy, real world of human dynamics. That is precisely the gap between a philosophical heuristic and a predictive science.
And that is exactly what the paper outlines in its future research agenda. The urgent need for empirical measurement, comparative cross-domain studies, and building computational models of these viability landscapes. But laying the structural foundation must come first. You cannot measure something until you have defined its parameters.
Fair enough. The viability grammar is a profound structural ontology. It finally provides a unified language for resilience across all complex systems. It takes the persistence problem, whether we are looking at metabolic stability in a cell, ecological basins of attraction in a forest, or institutional governance in a nation state, and proves they are governed by the exact same relational architecture. It demonstrates that existence under disturbance is not passive. It is an active, geometric process of constraint-aware regulation.
I hear your optimism, and I really do share your admiration for the scope of the work. But I will maintain that while it is a masterful interdisciplinary synthesis, it currently stands as a philosophical heuristic. It is a brilliant conceptual architecture awaiting the hard empirical operationalization needed to become a predictive science. Until we can calculate the margins and optionality of a complex adaptive system with the exact same precision that we calculate the tensile strength of that steel skyscraper we talked about earlier, we are still largely navigating in the dark.
But perhaps we are slightly less in the dark now than we were before. I think we can both agree that the highly fragmented, siloed sciences of the past century are just entirely insufficient for the modern planetary-scale challenges we face today. A global climate crisis doesn't respect the academic boundaries between atmospheric physics, ecological resilience, and institutional governance.
Oh, it attacks them all simultaneously.
Right.
Absolutely. On that, we have complete convergence. The challenges of the 21st century require us to look at reality through multiple intellectual traditions simultaneously, viewing these deeply entangled systems through the shared, rigorous lens of margins, constraints, and perception is conceptually invaluable. It finally forces the economist, the ecologist, the political scientist, and the systems engineer to sit in the exact same room and speak the exact same language.
And that shared language might be the first necessary step toward true persistence. We encourage you, our listeners, to dive deeper into the source material and decide for yourselves whether this framework is simply an elegant metaphor waiting for its mathematics or the dawn of a new empirical science of viability.
It's definitely worth the read.
Think back to that skyscraper we started with. The math of static steel is comforting, but the real world is not static. The real world is a constant barrage of unpredictable disturbances pushing against the boundaries of our constraints. The ultimate question is whether we can build systems with the perception to see those boundaries approaching, the optionality to find new pathways, and the margins to absorb the shock when the wind truly begins to howl.